Hello, I'm Tim Boson, and I describe myself as a semi-retired professor of anthropology and history. For 9 years, I was chair of St Albans Civic Society, and I'm now their honorary president. I also chair the voluntary organisations Blue Plaque St Albans and Conservation 50, and I'm on the Council of St Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society. An important part of these societies' activities is linked with the heritage of St Albans. So I thought it would be interesting to put together a series of radio programmes looking at the city's heritage. Each programme would examine a period of the city's history, and I would talk to local experts about its heritage. Today, I'm at Verulamium Museum, where I'm going to meet with David Thorold. Verulamium Museum, of course, is where all the Roman finds from the Roman site, which is now the wonderful Verulamium Park, are housed. So I'm going to introduce David. Hello, David. Thanks so much for agreeing to this interview.
Hello, nice to be here.
Can I start with some questions? Can you tell me a bit about yourself and how you're involved with Verulamium Museum? And how this has influenced your understanding of St Albans' heritage?
Yes, sure. I'm the curator of archaeology here, and I've been here now for, about 30 years all told. So I'm older than some of the exhibits now, which is a bit worrying. I studied at Newcastle upon Tyne. I was always interested in history. Went and studied archaeology at university there, and then excavated at a number of sites as an archaeologist, including one in St Albans, and that's where I got involved with the museum. So I started volunteering with the museum and eventually got a job here. And down the line, I'm the curator now.
Well, I've certainly chosen the right person because you've been here a good long time and must know St Albans very well. If we're doing this sort of in historical sequence, can you tell me a bit about what evidence is there for the Celtic settlement here of Verulamium?
Yes, it's a slight problem because the Celtic Iron Age settlement that we have here is largely underneath the Roman one, and we haven't yet excavated all of the Roman one. Actually, we've actually dug very little of the Roman one so far. So we only get a few glimpses really into the detailed knowledge of the Iron Age Celtic settlement that is there underneath. But there's enough there to know that there's a considerable amount of material there. In particular, we know that we're looking at farmsteads that are running across the whole area. So you're looking at farmers who are producing crops and keeping cattle and farming landscapes, which they're managing and controlling them. And they're spread quite a lot across quite a lot of the region here. And they're on the two valleys of here in sort of Verulamium Park. The two sides of the valley tops have settlements on them. We also know that in the sort of century before the Roman town came along, there was a gradual accumulation of people and activities here, which seems to be the early Iron Age settlement of Verulamium that becomes the Roman town of Verulamium. And we're still a little bit unclear as to how that comes about, but it's probably down to Julius Caesar. So I think that when you have Caesar leading his campaigns in Britain over 2 years, he doesn't really, he makes out in his books, his Gallic Wars, that he's had a great success in Britain. And when you look at the evidence, he's really got a bit of a score draw. You know, he's come over, tootled around a little bit and then gone home again. But what he does do, which is probably very helpful, is that he kind of follows a rule of divide and rule with the Britons. So some tribes he favours with new trade routes and trade deals, and some tribes he cuts out of those deals. And the Catavellauni, the local tribe of Hertfordshire, seem to be one of those tribes that are favoured, and they forge what seems to be a very strong relationship with the Romans. And part of that means that goods are being traded backwards and forwards. And it looks like iron work from cow roast and braffing is some of the things being traded out. And it seems likely that at some point, with this trade network developing, there was a need for a crossing point of the River Vyr. And it seems to have been a fairly slow-moving, marshy area at Verulamium, and that's why we think the site is called Verulamion. That seems to mean the place by the marsh. So that makes it a good crossing point. And once you've got a crossing point, you've kind of got a node of activity. If you've got trade and people passing through, then there's more reason for other activities to build up around it. And that's what we think happens in the 40 or 50 years before the Romans actually come in and sort of make Britain part of the empire. So what we probably have here in those early years is some sort of industrial settlement that's growing up based around this trade network. But we know very little about it in detail. We do find evidence for ironworking, though, and in particular, we have evidence for coin molds. So they are making Iron Age coins in the region around here in those decades before the Romans come in. And we also know that there is something of considerable size here at Verulamium, where St. Michael's Church now sits. And there is evidence from geophysics and aerial archaeology of a large ditch that is enclosing an area which is roughly the same as St. Michael's Church today.
That's absolutely fascinating, and it suggests actually that the Celts are much more sophisticated than Julius Caesar would portray them.
Yes, I think Caesar is writing a story telling everybody his side of things. So it's early PR, essentially. He's putting across a very positive spin on himself. I mean, it's very noticeable that he says the Britons are all, you know, doughty warriors covered in woad, fighting in chariots. And when you come to Verulamium, what you realise from the archaeological evidence is they're farmers. And it doesn't sound quite as impressive if Caesar says he's come and fought a couple of wars with some farmers and didn't really manage to get a lasting victory out of it. But I don't think that was what he was really doing when he was coming over. He's making a name for himself. He's using that to promote himself. And so, yes, the Britons are, it's a settled society in Hertfordshire and the southeast. You've got a class of society that you've got different classes. You've got the aristocratic elite. You've got free men who are holding small holdings. You've got possibly some kind of serf population that's working on the land of others but are free. And then you've got a slave element at the bottom. But you've got a very settled society by the time the Romans come over here. And what you don't have, and is something that Caesar does comment on, which seems to be accurate, is you don't really have major towns, because Britain in the southeast, which is what the Romans are really dealing with and trading with and coming over and experiencing, is very much a farming community. And if you're farmers, you don't build an urban settlement and then commute out for an hour to your farm every day. You live on the land. So we seem to have a population that's very similar to what you would have had in the 18th century pre-industrialization, working the land. But they're spread out across the landscape, so you see less of them. So built-up settlements are much more unusual. So Verulamium, the Iron Age settlement, is this sort of start of something new that you're developing here. And yeah, it's going to be fascinating when we do get down to find out more about it, but that's some way
so, off. So if I was asking you, Simon, what is the Celtic heritage of St. Albans? What would you say to someone? You know, where am I going to find the heritage?
Well, I guess really it's in the farming. And I think, you know, in terms of carrying through, that's still, when you look at the landscape, if you ignore things like roads and towns, the landscape is probably not that far off what we would have had. It's not a wooded countryside by then. So I think you're dealing with a local population who are farmers and working the land. There are some features in the landscape that we still see, because you are talking at a time where society is coming together. We do have aristocratic leaders, chieftains, if you will, local kings who are controlling a tribal area and have access to resources. So we do see features that are, you know, potentially prehistoric landscape features like Beach Bottom, Devil's Ditch, Devil's Dyke. So they are making an impact in the landscape that is still visible. The vast majority of what they're doing is farming, and you only see that when you excavate, but those boundaries, the ditches that are controlling territory, controlling how cattle are penned in and moved around from area to area, are visible. But you really need to dig down to find that. The really grand monuments that you see are largely the ditch and structures, because they would have had ditch and bank structures, which are partially delimiting the landscape, but also really promoting the guy who's responsible for constructing them, which is the local king. And the banks have gone, but those ditches still largely remain in the landscape. But you don't see too many of them, I think, because the Catavalor and I lived in Hampshire, they're a relatively peaceful, settled society. So I don't think you're looking at as many grand statements that you might see in some other areas.
So I guess this changes a bit with the Romans coming. So how did the Roman conquest actually sort of change the layout and the architecture of their city, Verulamium?
Well, the Roman arrival is probably less of a wrench for the Catavalorni than some tribe. As I've said, they were on good terms with the Romans. They've been trading with them for, you know, over 50 years. Caesar's almost a century back by the time Claudius's invasion happens. And over that time, you've got trade networks developing. The Romans often took hostages initially to encourage the good behaviour of the kings they left behind. And these were often the sons of the elite. And essentially, when you've got a good relationship, those guys are basically going back and being given a very good Roman upbringing. They're put into the Roman army as cavalry officers, for instance. They're well looked after on the basis that they're going to be the next rulers. So you've got about a century of members of the elite having been to the Roman Empire, possibly to Rome itself, being very familiar with it. So the top level of society are well aware of how the Romans operate. And it seems very much that when the invasion, which you kind of have to put in quotation marks, I think, for Verulamium happens, you actually see very little change, really, insofar as the Romans are not being opposed. When we look at the archaeological evidence, such as we have, we're not seeing destruction. And when you look at sites like Verulamium, what you're actually seeing is a certain amount of preservation and appreciation of what's already there, followed by a building up of the settlement. So it looks awfully like the fact that the local tribe were pro-Roman and the Romans had a good relationship with the local tribe, and they didn't come in and basically just take over, which is the case in some tribal areas. The Trinovantes of Essex, for instance, don't do very well under the Romans and are much more harshly treated. But we seem to have good evidence for continuity, that the local elite largely keep their lands and the population carries on doing what they were doing before. In the case of Verulamium, in those early years, when the Romans arrive, they seem to leave it alone. And that is probably because the local king is one of these kings who's very friendly with the Romans, and he's part of the invasion to some extent. It may be that he's actually involved with it and is supporting the Roman occupation in this area by actively, you know, proclaiming how good they are. And we don't know for sure, but it looks awfully like the local king is a chap called Adminius. And he's one of the sons of a previous king who the Romans traded with, and he stayed on friendly terms with the Romans. And the Romans would often arrange these deals with local kings where, for the lifetime of the king, they would continue to rule within the new province of Britannia that was being set up. And we think Adminius was around till around 55 AD, when we found a wealthy burial, which is the local client king, whether it's that named individual or not. So I think for those early 10, 15 years, the Romans are essentially leaving Verulamium as the local ruler wants it to be. And it's after he dies that you start to see the town gradually transforming and becoming more Roman.
So for the local aristocracy, the Celtic aristocracy, there's a lot of advantage in being Romanized for. Yes, so moving on then, David. I think most of us know about the Boudiccan Rebellion, and what was the impact on Verulamium of this rebellion? And the city was burnt to the ground, wasn't it? So how did it recover?
Yes, the Boudiccan Rebellion is interesting because it's probably the event that the average person is the most aware of. And rather frustratingly, it's the one that we probably know the least about, because much like the Iron Age settlement is buried under the Roman town, the Boudiccan Rebellion happens very early on in the history of Verulamium, the Roman town. And again, the evidence for it is mostly buried under the later town. So we have found evidence of burning from that period, and some of it definitely appears to be linked to the Boudiccan revolt. But you have to bear in mind that every time you find something burnt, it isn't necessarily Boudicca's fault. If this area is an industrial settlement, you've got a lot of blacksmiths operating in the area, and you've got a lot of chance of accidental fires. So it's not always the case that you can definitely tie it up. But it does look like we have evidence for destruction here. From the townsfolk's point of view, that's quite damaging. Although they are fortunate in that they have a bit of advance warning, because Verulamium is the last of the Roman towns that Boudicca's forces destroy and burn, and shortly after that she's finally defeated in battle. So the population's big advantage is that by the time the Boudiccan forces are bearing down on them, they've got a pretty good idea what's coming. And they are probably being seen as quislings by the rebels because they're on friendly terms with the Romans. So we suspect that the local population have scattered into the countryside and cleared off long before they actually get here, because it wouldn't have been very smart to have been hanging around, I suspect. The town is destroyed, but at least it looks like most of the population have survived. And after the revolt, they're able to return. And we don't really have, like I say, great knowledge of how quickly the town rebuilt, but it looks like it was relatively fast. In the year or two afterwards, there is a writing tablet that was recently found in London a couple of years ago, and it talked about trade, wagon loads of goods being transported between Verulamium and Londinium. So the economy's really up and running again very quickly afterwards, so it looks like that rebuilds quickly. To some extent, from the Romans' point of view, it kind of does them a bit of a favour, because the local client king has died a few years before the Boudiccan revolt happens, which is the point when the Romans will start redesigning the town along more Roman lines. And then Boudicca basically destroys much of what's there, which gives them a nice level playing field to start from again. So you do then see a Roman town layout developing, which is much more recognisably Roman. So we have Roman roads, a grid layout with blocks of land, little insulae blocks being laid out in between them. So you get a much more Romanized town developing from that point on. But it is notable that that potential area under St. Michael's Church, which we tend to refer to as the Chieftain's Palace, we don't know what it is, but it's something major, that continues to be respected by the new town layout. And eventually in time, that becomes where the Forum and Basilica complex, the market and economic heart of the Roman town, is constructed. So that always seems to continue being a site of importance. You've also got Watling Street approaching the town, which is laid out around 60 AD as well, about the time of the new town. And interestingly, as it approaches the town, it's actually coming in, if you look at it on a plan, it comes in at a 45 degree angle to the grid layout. So if the Romans were completely designing the town from scratch, you would think they'd reorient the town to fit the road that's coming through, or vice versa, but they don't. So you have Watling Street actually coming in at a funny angle. And in later periods, as Verulamium expands and does, you know, it's doing quite well, so it gets bigger and bigger, the later city blocks that get built are having to fit in around a pre-existing Roman road. And so you get some very odd-shaped ones. So there's a little block of land which had a temple in it, and it's known as the Triangular Temple because there's a small extra insulae block which is cut by Watling Street, which ends up with this weird little shape, and it's too small to do anything else with. So the Romans do superimpose a level of Roman design onto this town, but it always has these Celtic roots to it. They don't bother destroying that part entirely. They've got quite a laissez-faire attitude. As long as you're towing the line and not causing trouble, they're not too worried about you showing your Celtic roots.
I was going to say, quite respectful in a way. So it confirms what you were saying earlier about the relationship between the Catavalloni here and the Romans. And they were obviously working side by side. That's absolutely fascinating. Verulamium is one of the largest Roman cities in Britain. How does this Roman past set St Albans apart, say, from other English cities?
Well, I think St Albans is similar to a fair few. There's around 20 major Roman towns set up that are constructed in the early phase, and most of them are on pre-existing Iron Age settlements. So there are quite a few towns that do have a Roman past. I think what really sets Verulamium and St Albans apart is that ancient Verulamium was never built on by modern St Albans. So you have this unusual duality to the town. So whereas in many major towns the Roman remains become absorbed into a modern town and almost forgotten about, at Verulamium you still have those very much visible on and on display. So for instance, London has really only since the 1960s started rediscovering large amounts of its Roman past, and even quite recently they've found sections of still standing Roman wall which people weren't aware was there because it had become incorporated into later buildings. So a lot of those histories have kind of got forgotten to some extent, whereas at Verulamium, if you look at early surviving accounts, they're talking about the Roman town. It's still actively visible and present, and they're taking into account of it and comparing it to the later town. So Matthew Paris, in his accounts of the Abbey, talks of the Roman town, and he talks about a small part of it which he calls a propugnaculum, which is some sort of fortified defence, which was still owned by the king rather than the abbey in the 12th century. And what we think he's probably talking about is the gateway into the town, the London Gate, which is over on the side of St Albans where the running track is now. So that's now all gone, but it looks like that was still standing in the 12th century. In the early 18th century, you've got early antiquarians like William Stukeley coming to Verulamium and mapping the town, and he's drawing the town and showing he can still see the roads, the town wall is still largely visible, and he talks about how the local farmers have a very good understanding of the Romans because they're always digging up, ploughing up material in their ground. So I think the town of St Albans is always quite aware of the old town of Verulamium and sees itself as the heir to that town, and I think they've always been quite proud of it and, you know, pleased that it's got such a long history to it.
So you could say in a way that the Roman heritage is part of the DNA of St Albans, you can't escape it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating. Moving on, the Roman theatre is a rare example in Britain. almost unique, isn't it? How does St Albans balance the preservation of such an irreplaceable heritage with the needs and opportunities of a modern city?
Yes, it's always an issue. I think the fact that we're a little bit out of the town does help. The theatre itself is operated by the Gorhambury Estate and Heritage England, Old English Heritage as it's now is Heritage England, are involved with preserving the standing remains as they are with the material in the park. It is a case of us working alongside them where we can and monitoring and being aware of any major change. That it's much the same as the remaining fragments of the wall that we have in the park. It's really a case of trying to monitor that because we're here on site, so we can let Heritage England know if there's anything that needs to be brought to their attention, and trying to make sure that people are aware of it, which means they'll come and visit it, which means that it's at greater risk because there's more people accessing it. There's a little balance in maintaining those things. I think what we have, which is fortunate, is that Verulamium Park is a nice open space, and there are lots of opportunities for other things to be done in the park as well. And the heritage is one element of it, so it allows it to be used a little bit more selectively.
Yes, and of course the theatre is now being used for performances by the OVO company, which is it's nice to see something like that, providing an opportunity for citizens. But of course, as you were saying, there's always a slight risk, isn't there, with more visitors coming, the site deteriorating a bit more. So I guess it's something we just have to watch and be careful about.
Yes. It's not, again, there are events in the park and things are monitored, and at both sites, the protection of the monument is taken into account. So the activities that are going on at the theatre are basically constructed above ground. So there's nothing we're not having structures built on top, new staging going in that would damage any remaining archaeology in the ground. It's all freestanding on top of it. The theatre itself, a lot of what you see in terms of the banking is actually the upcast from the excavation of the theatre itself back in the 1930s. So it is excavated material, so it's not at the same risk in that way. So it is a case of monitoring it and working out what's acceptable and what's not, and where those optimum levels sit.
It's interesting about that because some people see them, you know, those banks, which a lot of rabbits seem to live there at the moment, and they think of that as being part of the original theatre. You say it's actually just the spoil.
Yes.
from the excavation.
Yes, it likely had the theatre would largely have been wooden structure, so you would have had seating on top of it. There would have been some earthwork elements, but I think most of it would have been a wooden structure. Yeah.
Good. Now I'm a visitor. What physical remains of the Celtic or Roman period can I see today? I've come to St Albans today. What are you going to show me?
Well, unfortunately, there isn't a huge amount of standing archaeology, but that's often the nature with British archaeology because the weather conditions that we have don't encourage standing materials to really survive. But we do have a few features. So there is in the park a mosaic floor with an underfloor heating system known as a hypocaust. And that's protected by a modern building and is open on weekdays and Saturdays at the same time as the museum is. So you can go into there and have a look at a mosaic floor and see how the Romans basically had central heating in their houses in Britain, which would have been a nice feature if the weather's anything like what it's normally like these days.
Quite essential.
Absolutely. We've mentioned the walls, and there are a couple of sections of wall that are still visible and on display. So there's a small section over by the lakes, which used to be, I think it was part of the boundary wall of a chapel that was built in the medieval times, and so that's helped that survive. And then there is a large section of the wall, probably the best preserved, which sort of runs from the lakes up to King Harry Lane, and there's a pathway running along there. So if you want to see a nice section of standing Roman wall, including some bastions and towers that still stand to a couple of feet high, that's the section to go to.
What sort of date would that be, David?
The town walls late 3rd century, so it is quite late. It's an interesting structure because it's probably not primarily military in its nature. The wall is a boundary, and it's potentially protecting you from disorganized troublemakers, but when you look at it, it's not really constructed in a way that would keep an army out. It gives away the high land on the sort of southwestern side, so you'd actually be looking up to any attackers if you came to it from that side. It may have an element of civic pride. It's very noticeable that the section of the town wall that still stands is the section that had the most towers, and it seems to have been thicker, which suggests it was built higher, and that's the side that you'd approach when you came from London. So it may well be that it's built to look impressive rather than anything else, and when you left from the other sides, if you didn't look back, you wouldn't notice that the town wall wasn't quite as impressive on those sections.
That's fascinating. So it's a bit of prestige as you come to the town. Oh, this is big and well defended, but in reality it wasn't quite that.
Yes,
story.
And it may well be town walls seem to be linked with the size of the forum complex, and Verulamium has a very large forum, and again I think that goes back to the fact that the locals and the Romans had a good relationship, and in the early years the Romans in particular wanted to show that if you played well with the Romans, they would play well with you, so you get a very grand forum and basilica complex built. So that may have a part of why the town wall is so big as well, that you have a big grand town wall because you've got a big grand forum out there. So yes, there's that, and there's also on that section there's the accompanying ditch which lies on the other side of the pathway, so there's a nice big ditch section that you can see in the park there as well. We also have, as we've mentioned, the theatre is open. That is operated by the Gornbury Estate, but that's open Monday to Friday on Saturdays as well. And then, of course, most of the objects that we've recovered are actually visible in the museum. So you can come to the museum and see all the things that we've excavated from sites on within the town and outside it, and that aren't necessarily visible in the park. So the chieftain that we mentioned, we've excavated his burial, so that's on display in the museum. There's a series of other mosaics. We've got some very good examples of Roman wall plaster from some of the wealthy townhouses that the local population, which were probably still Britons, were living in the 3rd century. So we know that some of the people here were extremely wealthy and had some very fine houses. And if I can do a little plug, we're open Monday to Friday from 10 till 5, sorry, from 10 till 4:30. And on Saturday, we're open from 11 to 3. So come in and see all that we've got.
So listeners, if you haven't been to Verulamium Museum, I think it's a must. Wonderful treasures here, and it gives you a real sense of what Roman life was like. So that was terrific. David, this has been fascinating. Are there any other thoughts that you might want to tell the listeners about?
I think that one thing we notice very much more and more as we excavate is that the similarities between people then and now, and occasionally the differences. But when you look at the life of the people that we find from the excavated remains, they're very similar to the lives we led. You're looking at people who are getting up, working for a living, and then finding some time to entertain themselves in the evening. And a lot of what they do is very similar. We don't find written diaries or accounts of people. That just doesn't happen really within the Roman Empire, and certainly within Britain. But you get a lot of evidence for how they're living from the objects they're using. And what you really see is that they have a mindset that's very much like ours in how they operate. And in some ways they're different because, as we've mentioned briefly, there is slavery within the Roman Empire and Roman Britain. And so there are some differences there. But even slavery was a curious thing back then, because you could potentially buy your freedom. So you could be a slave, but you could get out of slavery. So there were routes out of it. So in some ways they were very different to how we operate. But when you look at the basic way that people operate, they're often much the same.
Interesting, yes. We tend to think of those breaks in history, but actually there's an enormous amount of continuity. And probably many of our citizens here have some Roman DNA in their blood. I guess as it becomes more sophisticated and analysing this, we'll realise. Because the Romans is a very multicultural society, isn't it? That's how it operates.
It is, yes. The Roman Empire is enormous, and while not everybody is initially a citizen of the Roman Empire, over time that becomes more common. And you get emperors who are Spanish, you get emperors who are African. So it does become very much a melting pot, and you have lots of people passing through. The question we always get asked is, you know, who lived here? And you talk about Roman Britain, but probably most of the people who lived here were the Britons, because the Romans would have been living somewhere that was much more sunnier for most of the time. There are accounts of soldiers up on Hadrian's Wall who have written letters home that have survived, and they're writing home asking for their family to send them warm clothes, because Britain's such a cold and horrible place to be living in. So you wouldn't necessarily come and base yourself here, but you have got a lot of people passing through who are part of the empire. So troops moving around to different points within the province are passing through Verulamium all the time, and they come from all over the empire. We know that there are African troops based in Britain. We know different units are here. So you've got Spanish, you've got Gallic, you've got Italians, you've got all sorts. Verulamium, with its forum, it's a big market centre, and it's close to London, so you would have had all the goods that had crossed the Channel and come up the Thames. Anything going by land north of London, the first day stop you'll come to is Verulamium, so it's going to have a big market trading here. And you'd have had merchants going on further north, and they're going to be coming from the continent, so you've got all those going through. And you would have had members of the government, the white-collar elite, who were essentially keeping the province ticking along, carrying out the taxation, doing a lot of the law making. Those no doubt would have also been Italians or members of the Roman Empire who were coming over here and working while they were moving their way up the ladder to, you know, senatorial class potentially. So if you lived in Verulamium, it would have been a very mixed population. I think if you passed through the town, you'd have met a lot of people that probably a few different languages that you wouldn't necessarily recognise being spoken on occasion here as well. So I think Verulamium is very much a really interesting place in that point of view to see as well.
That's a wonderful picture of continuity. David, thank you so much for this interview. It's absolutely fascinating, and I've learned so much. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
I was talking to David Thorold, curator, prehistoric to medieval at St Albans Museum. Can I thank the sponsors of these heritage programmes? St Albans Cathedral, St Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society, City and District of St Albans Tour Guides, and finally Conservation 50.